So you're a member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and this year y'all named The Social Network as Best Picture. The Broadcast Film Critics Association, whose tastes really closely parallel the Academy voters, they haven't named any winners, but Black Swan did score a record 12 nominations, and now The King's Speech is picking up 7 Golden Globe nominations. Are these basically then the 3 favorites that you think going into the award season?
They have been, but what's unusual about them is I'm not hearing from any critics, even when we did our own vote this weekend, that they're feeling a lot of deep passion for any of these 3 films. They're all films that are good, and arguments can be made that they're the best film of the year, but I think that says as much about the year as it does about the particular film. Like, nobody feels especially stirred or moved or is, like, leaping to their feet in passionate defense of any of them, although they're all very, very fine. Well, at least 2 of them are. I don't like one of them. I can leave that as a mystery. I don't want to pick any fights.
Well, I did see that you tweeted out this week a comment from a friend of yours that said The Social Network keeps winning all these prizes because it's the only film that everybody's seen and nobody hates.
I think that's exactly it. She nailed it. That was my friend Karina Longworth. She's a critic out here at the LA Weekly. And that's the problem. When you have a group the size of any group, as large of ours, everybody votes with their conscience, but then they also add a secondary vote. Maybe I should actually explain how we vote. I think that makes it make a lot more sense.
Yes, please.
Okay, here's how we do it. Everybody gets in a room, and we know that this is going to take all day, so there's always plenty of food, coffee, we need it. We go by category, and when we announce a category, like, say, Best Picture, everybody yells out their picks, and you hear people screaming from all corners of the room. And we're a diverse group. I mean, we have an age range of probably 50 years between the oldest and the youngest critics. And people are just screaming out, like, Blue Valentine, Mother, Another Year. And we write them all up until we have everybody's nomination. And then we go around the room one at a time, and everybody announces their votes. And they get 3 votes, and they rank them according to points. So we do it by a point scale. So, you know, if it was me, I would go up there and I would say, you know, Yogi Bear 3, if I thought Yogi Bear was the best film of the year. And then I would say the A-Team 2, and then I would say Black Swan 1. And then they add up all the points at the end of it. And so whoever has the most 2 points from everybody, whoever gets the most 2s and 3s, we do a runoff between them. And those are our first choice and our second choice. And what's unusual is, like, a film can win the most points in the room, but then lose the runoff and become our runner-up.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's kind of how it happens. Like, lots of people will vote number 3 for something they like and vote number 2, or they'll vote 3 for something they love. And they'll give 2 points to something that they were okay with and would tolerate if it wins. And I think that's how a lot of these critics' awards groups get shaken out, with films that people don't disagree on, but nobody's going to fall on their sword defending as the best movie of the year.
Right. So it's your own little kind of strange sort of electoral college type situation.
Yeah, democracy in action.
Yeah. Well, you know, you alluded to this a moment ago. And so I might ask is, you know, these films, The Social Network, The King's Speech, and, you know, a lot of these films that people are not quite passionate about, I mean, are they going to be remembered years from now, or are they just kind of this year's flavor? That's the thing I wonder about a lot of times with the films that garner a lot of awards during the year. I mean, years from now, are we going to be remembering these films and rewatching them again?
I think that's a really smart question to ask, because I feel like the mark of a good film is that we do remember it. And, you know, if I was like, pop quiz, what won in 2002, everybody would have to, like, scratch their heads and think. But The Social Network will be remembered. And I don't think it will be because of the film, though. It will just be remembered as a monument to an internet institution that's shaping the lives of everybody in our world. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg told The New Yorker that he sees a future in which when you turn on your TV, you can see how many of your friends are also watching Grey's Anatomy right at that moment, because your Facebook will be connected through your TV, and it's all going to be part of one organism. And I think as we move towards that future, Godspeed if he gets it, which so far he doesn't seem to lose many battles he starts, we're going to remember this as almost archaeological history of what our world was like before and after. But that doesn't say we're not remembering it for the quality of the filmmaking, even though it is very quality filmmaking. It's an excellent film, very sharp and dark and mean and nasty, and it gets to the heart of the story. Even if that story may or may not be true, it's what's going to be remembered.
Mm-hmm.
As for the others, no. I don't think we're going to be talking about Black Swan in a couple of years. And King's Speech is one of the most likable films I've seen in 3 years. Like, you can't walk out of that film and hate it, but I will probably forget its name in 2 years.
But it's a good way to spend your holiday season, in other words.
Yeah, if somebody was going to buy a ticket this weekend, I would recommend it with five thumbs up.
Yeah. Well, the LA Film Critics also give an award that's close to my heart because I'm so interested in classic film, and that's this Legacy of Cinema Award. And this year, y'all gave an award to the team behind the restoration of Fritz Lang's Metropolis and also to the film Henri-Georges Clouzot's Inferno, which is about a film that the great director Clouzot was never able to really complete. Please tell me about the importance of this award and about these films that you've chosen to honor this year.
Absolutely. I mean, we actually make jokes in our award ceremony that some of the critics were around to review Metropolis when it first came out. But no, we're a group that really does have roots that stretch far, far, far back. And we're a group that really values history, and like we really love to see how films have started movements that have influenced our times, and we would like to go back and thank those people. I mean, last year we gave our Legacy Award to Jean-Paul Belmondo, which was amazing to have him come out and have a piece of film history, like, in the same room with us sitting at a table next to Jeff Bridges and, you know, to bring all these worlds together. This year we are there. It was almost a no-brainer voting on whether or not we should give Metropolis an award for the restoration. The only question we had is how complicated announcing that is going to be, because it was a process that involved like three continents.
Yeah.
You know, the film was found here, restored here, and released there with oceans in between them. So it's such a collaborative effort. We were almost like taking in a deep breath and being like, this is going to be complicated. But I mean, there's just no way you can even talk about the history of film without talking about Metropolis. And when you even look at films we've got today, you know, you take the production design of Tron and you can see that the green lines in Tron's grid stretch all the way back through the mechanics that you see in Metropolis. I mean, it's a landmark.
It's an amazing film. Well, Box Office Magazine, of which you're the editor, has traditionally been the magazine for the National Association of Theater Owners. And I wanted to ask, how's your audience changed in recent years, if at all?
It's changed a lot with the advent of the internet, because Box Office is a 90-year-old magazine. Actually, we're going to be 91 in January. We're older than almost anybody. We're about to launch on the iPad in January, and we were making books that we're going to be the oldest film on the oldest magazine on the iPad until Harper's announced that they're launching an iPad version, and they beat us by 70 years or 150 years, which is amazing. But that's our competition. The thing with Box Office is, we've been an industry magazine that's always been the voice of people who own movie theaters. That's historically been our angle, which has been great throughout the centuries, because we've been able to, you know, build that relationship between the people who show movies and the studios who want the people who show movies to want their movies in their theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So when we go back, like, we've interviewed, if you name basically an old celebrity, we've interviewed them, and that's continued. You know, we've talked to, you know, Charlie Chaplin, and we've talked to Cecil B. DeMille. And what we did is basically the internet has changed the entire game for us. When that came out and we started to put our content online, we realized that we have such a history and a knowledge base that we want to get that out to the public. And we have all these interviews that we're continuing to get nonstop. And so we've launched boxoffice.com, which is our like first URL, which is now where we keep all of our numbers. And we have boxofficemagazine.com, which is where we put all of our interviews. And we also have a link to our vault of history. And we just didn't want to keep this all to ourselves. So we're expanding, actually. And it's kind of exciting, like, to be with a magazine that's been around three times as long as I've been alive and be there with it as it, like, mutates and takes on new forms. We launched a fan magazine this year, Box Office Magazine, which is like the first time we've printed a publication that like the public is actually allowed to read.
Mm-hmm.
In print. And we distributed it nationally. We had 1.2 million copies, but none in San Antonio, which is so frustrating because I'm from there. But if you go to El Paso, we're in tons of theaters. That's the sad thing. And I want to change that. I grew up actually going to the Santikos theaters. I knew Mrs. Santikos as a child. We went to the same church. It's a small world.
Given that you have this new publication and you also have your online content, how do you differentiate yourself or compare with other trade publications like Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, or even popular magazines then like Entertainment Weekly?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that is something we talk about a lot. Like, I actually just got out of another meeting today about how is our podcast going to be different than everybody else's podcast, because – with the internet comes so much competition, like, you know, Vulture from the New York Magazine, from Gawker, from what used to be Defamer to Movie Line. And how do we differentiate ourselves from them is like the big question that every magazine is asking themselves. Like, how do we carve out a niche? Because the problem that you see with the internet is that it's amazing for disseminating information really quickly. I mean, if you guys want to even look on Twitter, you know, Yogi Bear new ending, that's a story that got out online in an hour and then was immediately over. Mm-hmm. That's where the animators from Yogi Bear, they animated the ending of the film to basically mimic the ending of the assassination of Jesse Jones. It's very, very dark. Boo Boo shoots Yogi Bear in the back of the head.
Yes, I've seen it. Those sad eyes are...
I'm rambling, but I'm just saying that, like, that's what the internet does now is it takes a story like that, puts it everywhere in an hour, but nobody's saying anything about it for real. There's no voices. It's just an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. And so our challenge is how to find our niche that's not the echo chamber. And what we're very sure of is that we're never a magazine that wants to deal with gossip. And we're a magazine that loves the movies, which sounds like a simple thing. But fundamentally, I feel like most of the blogosphere does not love movies. It's a machine designed for snark and for tearing everything apart, which even in my, you know, I've been a professional film critic now for going on 9 years. It's just so damaging to the industry in the way that we think of ourselves. Like, we love movies more than anybody, and it's hard for even critics to admit it.
Yeah.
And the internet's only made that problem worse. So we're definitely a site that's positive, and we'll ask tough questions, but we're not there to destroy. We're there to give people a chance to argue and defend and to think.
We already talked about the internet some, but you know, you've been a professional film critic for 9 years, you've said now. What do you think has been the biggest change in the industry over these past 9 years that you've been watching movies professionally?
I think the biggest change I've seen is just a sweeping cynicism that I feel has taken over both the business and the studios and even the audiences, because now the internet is inviting them to participate in the conversation about how cynical they are about Hollywood. And I feel like it is pushing films towards mediocrity because nobody's even expecting anything to be great anymore. And if a movie comes out saying, I want to be great, there's 1,000 voices that are ready to sharpen their knives, or I guess really sharpen their keyboards and take it down. And to me, that's one of the biggest problems I feel, is that there's a sense that nobody is sticking up for the smart, happy people
mm-hmm.
in film. And what I mean by that is, when a studio comes out with Yogi Bear, everybody sort of rolls their eyes and says, well, what do you expect? Americans will see any sort of terrible film. And nobody is giving Americans enough credit to want a smart film. And then even when a film like Inception comes out, and I'm not a huge Inception fan, but I really respect it as a film because it has such a strength of voice from the director, and because I'm really impressed that a film that a company like Warner Brothers would invest all that money in making a film like Inception that is so unusual, and then to launch it in the height of summer. And I respect that film for so many reasons. And it isn't the smartest film in the world, and I really do think if you think about it for more than 15 minutes over a beer with your friends, aspects of it will fall apart. But the enthusiastic audience response to a film like Inception, to me, shows that people are hungry for a film that challenges them and a film that asks them to play catch-up and, like, to chase behind the plot and to, like, bring their own mind to the film and to think of the cinema as a place that's interactive. And the reception to a film like Inception, like, excites me, and I want more films like that because I want to see studios taking a chance, and I want to also see studios respecting that their audience wants to be challenged. I think we've been told too long that people go to the movies to shut off their brain and be distracted. And I don't think that's true. And I think the more that we agree that it's true, the more we're going to see a continual stream of, you know, I have to go see Meet the Fockers tomorrow. No, not even Meet the Fockers, Little Fockers. That's where they're at right now. we're just going to keep going down that road because somebody needs to be the voice of the audience and say the audience is smarter than you think and the audience wants this stuff. And then I also think that audiences bear the responsibility of when an interesting film comes out, they go buy a ticket, you know, go buy a ticket to Scott Pilgrim. That is one of the most fascinating and personal and intimate and brave films I've seen all year. And people bootlegged it, which is terrible because when a film like that gets support from a studio, we need audiences to say, yes, we will pay money for you guys to keep making good products. But right now there's just so much despair, almost, that we're in kind of a death spiral where we're not getting good movies because nobody is supporting good movies at any level. Even critics get cowed from supporting good movies because everybody else is bagging them. And it's hard to, when you do stand up and be like, no, this actually is a film that deserves respect, you do get like thousands of negative comments. And I feel like I do see critics kind of fall under the pressure to be snarky and to just say that everything sucks and nothing will ever be good again.
That is a real shame, you know, because I would rather see a movie that is going for something and fails than have to sit through something like Yogi Bear or Batman and Robin or whatever the really awful, you know, blockbuster is. I mean, I think about, I was just rewatching some Richard Linklater films the other day, and it made me think of A Scanner Darkly, which I did not like, but I feel better about not liking that film than I do about not liking something like Yogi Bear, I guess.
That's exactly it. There's two types of not liking. There's, what I would say as a critic is my mantra is to try to judge a film against what it wants to do. And if a film has high ambitions, even if it fails, a piece of my heart will always go out to that film. It's the way I feel about The Tempest, which just came out, the Julie Taymor Shakespeare film.
Mm-hmm.
Which is getting destroyed and nobody's taking it seriously. But that is a film with a director at the helm who really knows what she wants to do. And it's passionate and crazy and wild and weird. And I think more successful than people want to admit. But I feel like when somebody jumps out of the box like that with something ambitious that isn't perfect, people will destroy it. People just won't even give it a chance because it's not impregnable the way a film like The Social Network or The King's Speech are impregnable. You can't criticize them, but they're not actually trying hard either.
Well, Amy, let me take you back a moment here to when you were growing up in San Antonio. I think this is a good opportunity to ask about you growing up and how you growing up watching movies. And this is, I guess, pre-Bijou, the film festivals that are starting to spring up around town, maybe were in their infancy or not around at all during the time you were here in San Antonio. When you were growing up in San Antonio, how did you feed your passion for movies, or did you feel like you were starving?
Actually, you know who was good at the time? I think, is it Crossroads that became the Bijou?
It is, and they were doing some things, and I don't know if they had completely been art cinemaized at the time.
Not completely, but I remember they were the place that if you wanted to see something interesting, they would have it, and they. I think my major movie memory of living in San Antonio in high school is going to Crossroads Mall to go see Pink Flamingos when they re-released Pink Flamingos and dragging along, I think, five of my friends to come with me to see Pink Flamingos. And I had never seen it, and I didn't know much about it. And this was pre-internet. I think I had an email address, but nobody ever emailed me on it, maybe. Actually, that might not even be true. It might be completely pre-internet. And so hearing that Pink Flamingos is a major movie, going out to go see it, and I love that moment when you're sitting down in the theater, knowing that you're about to see something that people have talked about, but not knowing why.
Right.
So sitting down at Pink Flamingos, watching that entire mess go down, you know, watching the woman in the baby cage eating eggs, and of course the signature, you know, the rape scene with a chicken, and the end where Divine eats, you know what she eats off the sidewalk, and sitting there with my friends being like, I can't believe I'm watching this on a huge screen. And being sort of amazed, and at that time, I mainly knew John Waters from Hairspray, and realizing that he could go this far back and be so much weirder than I ever knew he could be. And then, of course, walking out into, you know, the mall afterwards with my friends and having them say, you never get to pick the movie ever, ever again. Which is a true story, and I don't think I ever did. I don't think they ever let me pick again.
Well, when you left San Antonio, you you went to school, I guess, to study film. Then is that correct?
It is. Well, when I left San Antonio, I knew that I was really interested in the visual arts. I was devoted to photography at the time, but I also knew that I was really interested in people. And when you graduate high school and you think that you're interested in people, the thing that people keep saying you want to do is you want to be a psychologist. And so I went to school and I entered as a psychology major for like a semester and realized that wasn't it. And I kind of went on this trail because I always knew I wanted to talk about what people cared about and why, and like culture and what was our touchstone. And I never knew that that's what film criticism was. It took me 2 years to figure that out. I basically went from psychology to sociology to anthropology. And then while an anthropology major, I took a film class. And in my first film class, it was on films of the Great Depression. My teacher, Joanna Rapp, who's actually descended from Harry Rapp, who founded MGM, and she has a fascinating story about how he's been written out of history. But Joanna Rapp gave us this lecture one day about how when the Great Depression hit, you saw the rise of gangster movies starring Jimmy Cagney. But when FDR took over the office in 32, he went to Hollywood, and he knew enough, he was smart enough as a president, to have a meeting with studio executives and say, all right, I'm president now. This Jimmy Cagney shooting people in the face, this Marie Dressler starring as a poor woman from the docks, this isn't going to work anymore. I want to be the president of hope. And that's the year that they came out with Shirley Temple. And to see that there was such a intersection point between history and culture and the national mood and Hollywood was amazing. And to realize that you could read a film for its time, not just read a film and be like, oh, the red roses in the bathtub in American Beauty mean this, but to read a film and say, like, what were we worried about in 1999 when American Beauty came out? Like, what was our angst, or what were the questions happening in America? And to be able to use the film as a way to understand us, it's what I always wanted to do. I just never knew enough to put a name to it before. And I didn't know enough that you could actually be a film critic. In San Antonio, we only had one that I can remember growing up. And that was my process. It's what I hit upon. It's what I still love today.
And movies in that regard, I mean, they cover everything. You got history, you have anthropology, you have cultural studies. I mean, if you're watching movies and you love movies and you like to write about the movies, then you get to write about anything, really.
That's exactly it. Like, if you're curious about the world, the best thing you can do is watch and then think about a movie. And especially documentaries. That's my favorite thing. I used to do screening for film festivals when I first got out to LA. And I'd always cross my fingers that I'd get put in the documentary screener beat, because you'd watch 5 films a day, but at least if they're documentaries, you felt like you were at least getting some vitamins with it.
Yeah.
When I used to screen dramatic narrative American features for Sundance, and that's, to me, that was the worst gig in the world. I did it for 3 years, but you're watching 1,000 ripoffs of Pulp Fiction every day. You know? And Pulp Fiction is very important to a 24-year-old with a handy cam, but that's it. It's junk food. It's junk food. It destroys your life. Wait, no, that's way too negative. But
I see where you're getting at, though.
But yeah, I just, as an anthropology major, in my classes, they would say, you know, here is the pottery of the Yanomami tribe. And we would look at that pottery and we would extrapolate from that. We'd say, like, oh, they like hunting and they like weaving and they obviously live near these clays because these are the colors they have in the pot. And they don't have a history of kiln baking. They draw. You know, you can learn so much about, you know, of a distant culture from looking at a piece of their artifact. And I feel like films are the same way for Americans. Like, they're kind of our shared culture. They're like our touchstone. And I feel like they need to be accorded more respect as a tool of study, as an anthropological tool of study. And when people say, oh, but they're all, you know, big and mass-produced from a studio, in a way I feel like that makes the point even stronger. Because if a studio is going to spend, you know, $50 million on a film, they're going to want to figure out, what are Americans willing to spend, you know, $100 million worth of tickets to go see? And in that way, they sort of do look at the country as a whole, and they do try to figure out what the country thinks is interesting. And every big release, even if it's dumb, maybe Yogi Bear aside, but other than that, does try to hit on something that's going on in America that they think will motivate people to get into their car, drive to the studio, spend, you know, $11 for a ticket, buy some popcorn, and also bring some friends and maybe even buy it later on DVD. And that financial pressure makes film fascinating to me. It doesn't cheapen it at all.
Amy, that sounds like a good place to end. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Absolutely. And hello, San Antonio.